Thank you for downloading the podcast. It was a book special this week with the authors Martina Cole, Sebastian Foakes and Wilbur Smith. Well, I'm delighted to say that my guest in the studio today is Wilbur Smith, the best-selling author. Wilbur, welcome to Classic FM.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you are phenomenally successful. You've been a writer for over 50 years. You've had a whole string of successes. Your books have been translated into many languages and phenomenal sales. What do you think it is that draws people to your books?
I think it's because I write about people people at different ages in time.
Yes.
And I have a boyish sense of humour. I used to be known for my raunchy books. But my raunchy books are not raunchy anymore by the standards of the present day. And I think it's because I enjoyed writing them, and some of my pleasure in the book comes through with the writing.
And that translates, that transmits itself to the
reader.
I think so. Yes.
But on the other hand, I don't like to think too closely about it. I know I write the books the way I like to write them, and people seem to enjoy reading them.
You had what I regard as the perfect childhood. You grew up on a cattle ranch, that's right, in what was northern Rhodesia.
Yes.
And it just seems to me that it was idyllic. You were free to roam and explore and do all the things that little boys love to do. Tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was very fortunate to have the type of childhood that you've described. My father started off when I was an infant, working very hard on the copper mines, and he accumulated enough money to buy a very nice 25,000-acre yacht ranch, and I spent the rest of my time there until I was about 8, and then I made a very bad decision. All my friends were going off to boarding school, and I thought, it must be a good thing to do. So I went to my mother, because I always broke the news to my mother. I said, I think I should go to boarding school. She said, my darling, just don't talk about that. I like you here. So anyway, then Dad overheard. And he said, well, why not? He's a boy. He goes down to boarding school. And then I went into the old-fashioned sort of British-type boarding school.
Yes, I know.
And the things that stand out in my mind was the loneliness and hearing other little boys weeping at night because they wanted to go home, and the sound of the cane clapping around your bottom, things like that.
Yes.
So, I did my time in the trenches, put it that way. then I came out, got a job. First of all, I said to my father said, what are you going to do with your life? I said, I want to be a journalist. He said, don't be a damn fool. You'll starve to death. So I went and got a real job. I did a CA, chartered accountancy. And when I finished, main thing is I went straight back to doing what I wanted to do. And at 25, I wrote my first novel. And I put all the mistakes into it that people usually do with a first novel, and it was never published. It's gone and forgotten. And then I wrote my second book, and I wrote for myself because I knew it was never going to be published.
Yes,
I see. And it was published, yes. And since then I have been unemployed.
Now, I know that you think it's very important, A, to write for yourself, but also to write about what you know. And I imagine that wonderfully free-ranging, adventurous childhood informed your writing, because your books are cracking good stories and full of adventure and on an epic scale as well. And that's true of Golden Lion. Perhaps you can tell me a little bit about Golden Lion without giving too much away.
Well, Golden Lion is one in a series of the same family, the
Courtney
family.
Yes.
The first book I wrote was When the Lion Feeds, and there was a Courtney in it. That was my first one. So I have a great affection for the Courtneys. Mm. My grandfather's name was Courtney, and so that's where I got it from.
Yeah.
So the Courtneys are members of my family, and I've written with great pleasure, and I've carried them from right through from the earliest times,
yes,
and through both world wars, and they stay with me. But my favorite at the moment is the Taita series, mm-hmm. which are the ancient Egyptian
yes.
series. And those have been very well received. But it's all my own imagination goes into the story. Some people say to me, oh, but it wasn't like that in ancient Egypt. And I say, oh, so you know you were there, were you? but it's fun.
I mean, you obviously have a fantastically fertile imagination. Do you ever wonder or worry that perhaps the ideas will start to flow less easily, that there might be a time where...
Certainly. You know, I'm not going any younger, but they flow more slowly, but they flow with force.
Which is terrific. I mean, that's a wonderful thing to be able to say.
Yes.
And what about research? Do you do quite a lot of meticulous research? Is that a part of writing that you enjoy?
I've done all my research. It's done. I'm just picking up the things I like.
Yes.
I go back, reread stuff that has grown a little bit stale. I go back and reread my books because some of them I haven't read for 50 years.
That's a good point.
It's very interesting to do that, you know. To pick up a book that you wrote 48 years ago and think, wow, that's not bad. And then, oh, God, I didn't write that. nothing is perfect, but everything is fun.
Do you have a typical working day? Are you quite a disciplined writer?
You have to be to get books done. Mm. You have to decide months in advance when you're going to start writing. And then you write 5 days a week. You take 2 days off to relax, go fishing, or
yes.
whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And in the morning, sometimes it's, oh, I don't think I could face the writing today. But you sit down, and then after a very short while, the ideas start to flow. And sometimes you'll end the previous day's writing, not entirely certain, you know, what do I write now?
Yes.
And you go to sleep, don't think about it, and you wake up in the morning, you think, yes, I'll write about that.
You've resolved the problem.
Yeah, that's
yes.
right. It's almost done subconsciously in your sleep.
I was also going to ask whether you have to be in a particular place in order to write, or can you write anywhere?
No, I write where it's quiet. I wrote all my first books, 18 of them or something like
yes.
that, longhand, because I couldn't type. And then I decided that computers, this new thing called a computer, I'd have a look at it, and I said, oh, that looks fun. You know? And so I started writing on a computer and typing.
What I really like about your books is that you're very good about the savagery of Africa, the fact that it's untamable, it's really wild. Can you elaborate on that? Because you do that particularly well, I think.
Africa is different from the northern world. I love the African people, and I've known them all my life from when I was a small boy.
Yes.
My earliest friends were black boys and girls on the ranch, and I understood their attitude towards life. It's different because Africa is a totally different country,
yes.
and it has savagery, but there's a huge amount of custom and courtesy. They have a lot going on for them and a lot going against them, but it's the same the world round. Nothing is perfect and nothing, but most things have got something good in them.
That's very true.
And Africa itself, the array of wildlife and birds, that is, for a small boy, is incredible. And everything from the dangerous game to the little impala and dika and small
yes.
animals, they are what define Africa for me.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful quote that I read somewhere that is related to you from Rudyard Kipling, which is, "Fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run." Would you say that was your philosophy?
I try to make it. I don't always get there. Some of my seconds and minutes are wasted, you know, in just daydreaming. But Rudyard Kipling was a splendid man. He was an absolute genius. He's out of fashion now.
That's true,
and,
yes.
And that quote, that poem that you quoted is old-fashioned. People think, oh, that's just nonsense. But it really is, contains so much truth in it. Yours is the world and everything that is in it. And what is more, you'll be a man, my son. My mother first read that to me, and she embroidered it on and put it at the head of my bed. So it's been
so
very close to me.
It was always there, yes. I'd like to ask you about classical music, and I wondered whether that plays an integral part in your life.
I love music. I love jazz. And I love, it depends on the mood.
Yes.
I love some of the old composers, Rimsky-Korsakov, Wagner, Beethoven. Mm. But like all things, some of it's good and some of it I can do without. But I do like classical music, and I think it's a very important thing. It's so relaxing to, when you're driving a car, to put it on or when you're reading a book playing in softly in the background. I like the lyrics of stories because I deal in words.
Of course, yes.
But the sound of music is just incredible, and it lulling, and I think it strengthens you and relaxes you.
Can you write to music? Are you able to write to music?
Oh,
or is
yes.
Too distracting?
But it depends. The volume down. Volume down, so it's just a background noise. And music is very much an integral part of a civilized man's and woman's existence, I think. If someone says, oh, I don't like music, you can say, well, you're missing a great big slice of life.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Mm. Wilbur Smith, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
I'm joined in the studio by the best-selling author Martina Cole, whose new novel Get Even is out now. And that's the latest, Martina, isn't it, in a long line of best-selling books?
Oh, it's her 23rd novel, and to be honest with you, I'm still amazed that we were on the 23rd book. I still feel like I'm on the second or the third one.
That is incredibly prolific. And how many books have you sold? Is it something like over 14 million?
I think it's 16 million now.
Is it?
It's 16 million, yeah.
Tremendous. And
they are phenomenally
successful, which is terrific.
I think I'm really, really lucky. You know, I wrote a book at the right time. For women, you know, for like strong women. And
yes.
I think if it got published 10 years earlier when I'd written the original novel, Dangerous Lady, I don't think it would have got published at the time.
What
I think there's always
a
time for things, and I was lucky.
You just hit the right time.
Hit the right time, yeah.
What is the secret of your success? Because you're plainly touching a chord, because people love what you write.
I think my books are these powerful, powerful stories, you know. And I think obviously I write from the point of view of the criminal, not the police, so they're not police procedurals or anything like that. But also I write from the female perspective. I write what happens if you're their mums or their girlfriends or their wives or their sisters, and, you know, how you cope in that world. And often I write about how that world can go so bad for you. You can have everything one minute and nothing the next. Losing the man you love for 25 years is a big...
Yes.
Big. I mean, that was the good life. That was what the good life was about. My book before Gay Even, you know, they had all this wonderful life. And then he got 25 years. And how do you keep a marriage together? How do you keep a family together?
Without giving too much away, can you tell me a little bit about Get Even?
Well, Gay Even's about this really wonderful girl, Chris. And she marries two men, and both of the men in her life have got a secret. And I can't tell you what the secrets are without giving the game away. But the first husband, she finds out his secret, and it gets him, you know, he ends up getting murdered. And then the second man in her life, another criminal, this time from the Northeast, knows a bit more about that secret, her first husband's secret, than he should. So she's betrayed basically twice in her life by two men she absolutely adored. But none of them really wanted to hurt her. Sometimes I think secrets don't necessarily you know, not against you personally, and these aren't anything to do with her. These are just events that's happened in these men's lives, and it destroys her each time.
Something also that you're keen on is the fact of taking responsibility for your own life. And being
a great believer in that, yeah. If I ruled the world and I could wave a magic wand, every girl in school would learn to keep themselves before they left school.
That's really important, actually, and I think that comes out in your strong female characters as well, that they are able to do that.
It's so important, I really do. I mean, you know, I do a lot with one-parent families and gingerbread and everything, obviously, and it breaks my heart because sometimes a lot of the young mums and things aren't on their own because they choose to be. These men have gone on and made other lives for themselves, yeah. or you know, some of the women's lost their husbands in Afghanistan, or have, you know, there's all different reasons that makes you a one-parent family, and I think that's why I have such a problem with the stigma. And that's why I believe, for me, if I could wave a magic wand at all, every girl that left school would be able to balance a checkbook, work if she had to, and make sure that she knew that, you know, when you have children, it isn't always the most fantastic experience of your life.
Yeah, these are life lessons, really, well, aren't they?
Women are brought up on Cinderella and men are brought up on Penthouse. I think that'd be two completely different ways of thinking. Look for your, you know, your prince, and men are grown up saying, go on, get as many women as you can. So I think we have to understand that, and I think with the advent of the internet and everything, I don't think it's getting easier for women. I think it's getting harder.
I certainly wouldn't
want to be a young girl nowadays with the body image expected and everything. I really, really wouldn't.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, even children as young as 7 or 8 are having problems with how they look.
I know. Do you know, my daughter's 18 now, my Freddie Mary, and I remember she was about 6 or 7 and this girl said to her, don't you think you're quite heavy? And I was like, what? I couldn't believe it.
She was perfectly normal.
She was perfectly normal, yeah. And I was looking at this little girl who actually looked like she could do with a good meal, you know, but I wouldn't dream of saying that. I just wouldn't dream of saying it. But there's so much pressure now, even on little children.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And I think that's the downside for me with the internet and everything.
I wanted to ask you more about that work because you're passionate about inspiring other people to read.
Yeah, I do, and it doesn't have to be my books either. I think anyone should just read. I mean, if you can, I mean, when we do the 6-book challenge, you don't have to read 6 books. You can read 6 pieces of poetry. You can read 6 song lyrics, you know, to whatever you like or however, you know, good at reading you are, whatever, how far you've come. I love that in the prisons it oftentimes gets people through the basic literacy courses. One of the saddest things I've found in the prisons is the amount of young men who can't read and write, and can barely read and write.
Yes.
One of the great things as well is, though, is when you go in there and someone says, you know, God, I read a book for the first time ever, I read a book, or I'm back reading. You know, and when I do the writing classes, the first thing I would say is, you know, the one thing authors want is time, and you've all got time to make the most of it and write your book.
True.
Yeah. It is. The one thing most authors want is time. And, you know, most of these have got plenty of time. Yeah.
When you were a child growing up and you loved to read as a child, which were the books that you read and inspired you?
When I was about 3, my dad was a merchant seaman, and it was very great if you come home for Christmas, you know, and we all used to lay in bed and wait for the black cab, you know, the noise of the black cab to come. And he brought me back this from America, this sort of like cardboard theatre. And when you opened the curtains, it had all the little rose red and books and all that. And I just loved it.
Yes.
And my nanny Loughlin, she taught all us to write our names before we started school, you know, and started us off reading. And I just always loved a book. I can never resist a book. I spend hours and hours and hours in bookshops. I mean, it's really mad now because when I sort of go to New York and I go to a Strand bookshop, they know me now and they haven't seen me for like a year. They go, oh, hello, Martina. Or I'll go down on, you know, Santa Monica. There's this really wacky bookshop there. And the lady there, she says, I've saved some books for you because I am a big... And even in Istanbul, I go to Istanbul a lot. And there's a guy in Istanbul in one of the bookshops in Sultanahmet, and he saves all the Elie Sharifs and he gets them for me in English, and he finds all these sort of, you know, all the authors that I love, like the Egyptian authors and Turkish authors and everything, and he gets me all the books in English, and it's wonderful. I think I love reading so much, I want to give that to other people who maybe haven't experienced it.
Yes, And give that pleasure back. I mean, it's such a wonderful world to be able to enter and immerse yourself in.
I always say, you know, when you read a book, you can be in outer space, you can be in love, you can be doing so many things, you can be underwater, you can be in Russia, you can be anywhere in the world. And for me, I think that's always been the big draw of books, is that it transports you into someone else's reality. And yes. I just absolutely love that.
And who are the authors as an adult who've influenced you along the way?
My favourite, and this is going to sound so crazy after all I've said, but my biggest influence was A.J. Cronin's Hatter's Castle. And I bought it at a jumble sale when I was a kid, and I'd never read anything like it. I mean, it's a Tunbridge disaster, throwing his daughter out of the house in this, you know, because she was pregnant in this thunderstorm. I mean, it was so melodramatic. I loved it. And her boyfriend, you know, is on the Tunbridge, isn't he? And the son running off with his father's mistress. I mean, I was like, my eyes was out on stalks, I couldn't believe it. And I think that's what gave me this great big OMG, because I felt the same. I remember sitting with my mum when I was a kid watching Mildred Pierce, you know, them big, powerful stories of big, powerful women. And I think that's probably what started me off on the road to wanting to write.
Now, I've seen you describe yourself as a dogged writer. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, sometimes I just write, I go and I don't want to do it. I mean, there's a funny, I talked about her earlier, a lovely lady called Gilda O'Neill. Gilda used to ring me up and she'd say to me, I really don't feel like working today, Tina, if you can't buy a lipstick. And I was going, yeah, all right then. Because I think most authors, we procrastinate, we do it. But then I get to a stage and I go, do you know what? You're going to sit there and you are going to do that. And then that's when it all just goes bang. And I write in long, long bursts, maybe 20 odd hours at a time.
Gosh. Really concentrated.
The second or third edit, I just go for hours. And my agent, Darlie Anson, says, I think that's what makes them the page turners, because you write them in such big bursts of energy. That's what makes people read them in such
bursts. Transmits itself to the page, yes.
Yeah. And but I think I'm so lucky, because I get to do something that I love. And I've spent so many years going to work just to pay the bills at a job And I think when you do get a job you love, it's the best feeling in the world. Yeah, because we all have to work. It's the law. You've got to work. You know, if you want a life, you have to work. And I love that I now have a job that I adore. I remember once... a journalist said to me, don't you ever get lonely, Martina, all on your own, you know? And I said, well, no, not really, because I'm with people I want to be with all day. And if they get on my nerves, I can kill them. And it's so true. I mean, how many people can say that? You know, and I do, I love the whole concept that you live in your own world. You put the wallpaper on the walls, you give people life, you give them cars to drive, life to live. And I mean, what can be greater than that?
Now, this is Classic FM. I wondered if classical music is important to you.
I do like classical music, I must be honest, but I couldn't say, oh, this is by Grieg or this is by this person. Although I do have some classical music, but my mother would have been the person, because my mother was absolutely crazy on all kinds of music. And my dad used to say on a Sunday when my mum was cooking at dinner, you could tell what mood she was in by what music was on. So if you had opera, because she was a great one for like La Traviata was her favourite, and Scheherazade.
Oh, yes.
She was absolutely mad on her music. If she had jazz on, it was a different ballgame. If Charlie Parker was on, she was in a good mood. And if it was Irish rebel songs, none of us came in. We were staying in the garden, yeah. But my mum, and she, I mean, I grew up on Bessie Smith. We grew up on such fantastic music. I mean, the one thing my mum gave us was fabulous music. And I can remember playing Pink Floyd, and she used to shout up the stairs, turn that up. And it was mad because it was my mum, and my mum was like really old when I was born. I was the youngest. But she was also mad on sort of, you know, Round the Watchtower.
Yes.
And The Wind Cries Mary and all these, you know, sort of.
She loved.
Yeah, she loved every kind of music. But the one, I think, for me, which probably isn't a very good classical song if you're a classical music maniac, would always be, I think, listening to La Traviata And it's there was one song, which I'm not going to sing, but it used to, I think it was a real resonance for me. And obviously Carmen, I mean, Bizet's Carmen, we grew up
character.
On that. She loved it. But that's as far as my knowledge goes. I remember playing the Trout Quintet and things to my daughter when she was a baby.
That's lovely.
But I'm not No. I couldn't say to all that's Rachmaninoff or something like
but
that.
But you certainly enjoy listening.
I do love listening. Do you know, funny enough, my son is nearly, my son's 38 now. My son has always got Classic FM on, and he's a big... And you know, it's strange, when he was really little, he heard the 1812 Overture when he was about four. And I was playing it, funny enough, and he absolutely loved it. And I had to tape it for him. And I used to hear him playing it. And when he was old enough, I gave him Gorky Park to read because they'd done the murder, didn't they, when the cannons went off. And so when he was old enough, I said, you know, you love that music. He said, yeah. I said, read that book. So there's a literary reference, I suppose, to that.
Absolutely perfect.
Yes, but I don't know very much.
Martina, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for coming
in. Thank you, it's been lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Well, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by the author Sebastian Foakes, whose latest novel, Where My Heart Used to Beat, is now out. Welcome, Sebastian, to the Culture Club.
Thank you.
Now, you're extremely good about writing about war and the great pressure that war exerts on relationships. And I wondered what it is about war that fires your imagination.
Well, I think that war is a bit of a gift to a writer, really, provided you stay away from the tanks and the regimental badges and the numbers and details. And the way I see it is it's just like putting human beings into a cauldron, a melting pot, and to see what they're made of. So if you take the sort of rough human material and you want to see what we are, what we're made from, there's nothing like having someone in a slit trench with people dying all around him to find out.
Now, your father fought in the Second World War. I wondered whether perhaps that influenced your interest. Did you hear stories from him about his experiences?
Very few, because in common with a lot of men, most of our fathers and grandfathers who fought in the Second World War didn't really talk about it a great deal. And those who did were rather despised as saloon bar majors. And one suspected that they hadn't seen very much action. They'd spent most of the time guarding the gasworks and at home. But eventually, my brother and I persuaded him to tell us a bit more about what he'd done. And he then actually wrote it down, not for publication, but just for us, so we'd have a record.
And writing about war must involve a huge amount of research.
It requires a fair amount of research, but mostly, you know, you just make it up. I mean, what you have to do, what's interesting about a novel is for the reader to feel that he or she might have been there and what it was like. And I can't really get that from research. I can't get that from copying, though, of course, I've read lots of documents and I've read lots of histories and I've been to the places. You can only get that feeling of immediacy, this is what it felt like feeling, by inventing it. Mm-hmm. And that's what novelists do. That's our claim on your attention and on your credit card. That's our gift. You know, no one else can do that. Well, I say it's our gift. You may judge that we haven't got away with it, but that's what we're trying to do.
Yes. And where did the idea for Where My Heart Used to Beat come from?
I wish there was a simple answer to that. If I knew where ideas came from, I'd buy a house there, but near there, and drill a well and have them
off you go.
Have a permanent supply. They come from sort of fragments from out of your unconscious, out of your dreams, out of your conversations, a lot from reading other books, meeting people, overhearing something on the bus. But undoubtedly, one of the starting points for me was a long time ago, on December the 31st, 1999, watching in the Millennium Dome, the end of the Millennium celebrations with the Queen and Tony Blair. And to me, the end of the millennium wasn't that interesting because 1,000 years, I mean, you know, this is too long to have any character. But the end of the 20th century, now that was interesting. And I watched the monarch and the prime minister both all at sea, not knowing what to do, whether to hold hands. And I just thought, oh, I don't think they've understood anything about what we've been through and what is coming to an end. Mm. So that, in a sense, is what this book is about, which is, it's about the 20th century. The 20th century, as somebody said, is the sort of main character in the book. What went wrong? What went right? How did we get into this terrible mess? How the world in Europe was transformed through the course of the century? And could we have made, frankly, a better job of it?
Well, let's pause now for some music, because we asked you your musical choices beforehand, and you like Erik Satie. So we're going to play the Gymnopédie number 1.
Thank you.
That was the Gymnopédie No. 1 by Satie, played by Jean-Yves Thibaudet. You're listening to Classic FM, and my guest on the Culture Club is the author Sebastian Folkes. Sebastian, can you listen to music while you're working, or is it too much of a distraction?
I'm afraid it's too much of a distraction. I used to, years ago when I first started, there were certain kinds of slightly mechanical pop music or sort of soft, rocky kind of things which didn't have too many peaks and troughs. But nowadays, no. In fact, I have some difficulty listening to music altogether, actually. I find that either it's just slightly an annoying sort of background buzz, or if you actually get into it, it's completely overwhelming. So I can't really go halfway.
There's no happy medium, is there?
And
I know what you mean. I sometimes try to read with music on, and I invariably end up listening to the music.
Yeah.
Or that always seems to dominate the reading for some reason. When did you first know that you wanted to be a writer? Were you the sort of little boy who was pretty certain that that was what he wanted to do when he grew up?
Yes, well, it depends what you mean by little. When I was, very little, I wanted to be a taxi driver or possibly an engine driver. But I was quite sporty and I liked running around and kicking footballs and so on. But round about the age of 14 or 15, so that sort of age, I think, when I started to read grown-up books for the first time, and that was just such a sort of bombshell, such a revelation to me, that there was this whole, as it were, hidden continent of people's inner lives. And up until that point, I wasn't really aware, I think. I must have been a very self-absorbed child. I wasn't really aware that other people had inner lives. When I read D.H. Lawrence and Jane Austen and Dickens and people, it came as an absolute bolt from the blue. Anyway, so from about that time, and I liked also, it appealed to me as a teenager, that all these novelists were so anti-establishment. They were so trying to pull the rug away from teachers and grand people and rich people and posh people. Even someone like Jane Austen, people think of as old-fashioned. She's not. She's absolutely wicked.
Yes. So
that, of course, appealed to me greatly as a teenager.
And would you say that Jane Austen and D.H. Lawrence are authors who have influenced you in any way, or have you really ploughed your own particular furrow?
The question of influence is tricky, because you'd like to be influenced by these people, because you would hope some of their brilliance might rub off on you, but I think it's a sort of one hope, really. I think certainly from D.H. Lawrence, what struck me when I read his books, first of all, at that age, was how much he loved his characters, the intimacy, the tenderness that he showed towards them. And if you'd been brought up on Agatha Christie or adventure stories, Alistair MacLean, this, again, was sort of completely extraordinary. So I thought, gosh, it's as though they're his children. He loves them that much. So I tried to imitate that, I think, a bit. But I think imitating the style of people is a dead end, because you sound like a parody or a knockoff. And, some of my very favourite writers have very distinctive styles, and I try very hard not, in fact, to be influenced by them.
Yes. Now, you obviously are a very successful author. Does the pressure to write a successful novel get worse the more successful books you have behind you? Is there an enormous weight of expectation?
Oh, I hadn't thought of it, but thanks for putting the thought in my mind.
That's really unpleasant, isn't it?
No, I do. I'm frozen there. Yes and no. Not really. It's the only thing I can do. I've got to do it. I enjoy doing it. And I did think, as I was publicising Where My Heart Used to Beat, various drill halls and bookshops and disused churches and gabbling into radio microphones, and looked at the book, and 15 novels I've written, I think, what am I trying to prove? some idea will come along and find me, I think, and tap me on the shoulder. That's a line from Perry Como, I think, isn't it? And the good thing about going out and doing the publicity is that you meet people, and I'm incredibly touched by their response. They are so passionate, so enthusiastic, and they come up after I've done a reading and they tell me what such and such a book has meant to them. These readers whom I meet, some of them, and the vast majority, of course, whom I don't meet, they are close to me. I think about them a lot, and I would like to carry on being in touch with them.
Now, your second musical choice is something by Sibelius, and we're going to play Finlandia. Finlandia by Sibelius, played there by the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra under the baton of Andrew Davis. This is Classic FM. I'm Charlotte Green, and my guest is the writer Sebastian Folkes. Sebastian, what is it about Sibelius and his music that appeals to you?
Well, actually, Fernandio is a bit cheesy, isn't it? I mean, he does a great ending, Sibelius.
That's true.
He had a very good ending there. I really like his symphonies, and what I like about them is very simply their construction. Mm-hmm. And when I write novels, they're always in my mind, at least, based on a symphonic construction of. They're about themes, and I don't enjoy reading novels which don't have themes. A novel's got to be about something. So in my view, you set out what it's about and then you vary it and then you set up a few minor themes and then you recapitulate and bring them all together in what you hope is a satisfactory Sibelius-like conclusion.
they work for me. I think your writing is terrific. Now, you used to be a journalist. I think you were the deputy editor of The Independent on Sunday, and you've now become a full-time writer, which I assume is a pretty solitary activity. I just wondered how you counter the solitude and whether you miss the hurly-burly of having a working with colleagues.
Yes, I miss it a bit. Well, I've been 25 years now in solitary confinement. And the first 10 years was pure joy and, you know, just absolute freedom and exaltation. But it has began to wear me down a little bit. And I occasionally miss meetings and the water cooler and chatting around coffee and so on. But I'm trying to write a few film scripts and I go to meetings with people about that. That's a sort of thing. And I do a bit of charitable stuff and that gets me out and about a little bit. But it's that balance is elusive. It's difficult. And people who are friends of mine who still work your full-time 9 to 5 say, "You're mad. It's ghastly. We just spend the whole day in meetings on the phone. Oh, dude, you're much better off as you are." So, yeah, you know, it's a balance for everyone.
Now, some of your work has been adapted for the stage and film. I wonder whether you feel proprietorial about your characters and worry about what's going to happen to them in a different medium.
Yes, you do a bit. I mean, I had to be terribly careful. I've been so hideously misquoted about on this, but here I am. I'm saying, and no one's misquoting me, I'm quoting myself. I've been very fortunate in the two adaptations I've had. In the casting, Eddie Redmayne was the lead character in Birdsong on television, and Kate Blanchett was the lead character of Charlotte Gray in the cinema. And you couldn't possibly ask for better actors than that. So I've been incredibly lucky, and I admire both of them beyond measure. Okay, that's the official, that's the quote, that's the truth. Don't misquote that. On the other hand, of course, I would like to have more control over what is said, over the dialogue and so on. So a few years ago, I said, from now on, I'm not going to pass on control of that to other people. From now on, if anyone wants to make an adaptation of a book I've written, that's great, but I'll do the writing, thanks very much. And they also, people in the film world said, "Well, no one's ever going to agree to that." And I said, "Well, fine, I don't care. Let's not make anything." But as it happens, actually, a couple of them are now sort of, well, touching wood, on the runway. But
are you able to say?
Yeah, an adaptation of a book called The Girl at the Lion d'Or.
Oh, yes, yes.
And one called On Green Dolphin Street.
Ah, good. That's one of my particular favourites, actually. I really like On Green Dolphin Street. That stayed with me. I mean, it's about, what, 14, 15 years ago?
Yes,
since you,
yes.
And I particularly enjoyed that and the setting, America in late 50s, early 60s.
Well, that's been fun. I've written the adaptation of that and The Girl at the Lion d'Or with a friend called Rachel Wagstaff, who adapted Birdsong for its stage, touring stage production. And it's been a long, hard road, and, you know, we're not there yet, and still, it's terrible business making films. You need about a dozen balls all in the air at the same time. We've got about 10 up, but each one of the rather heavier balls to get up there is 10 million quid. But anyway, let's hope for the best.
Well, I wish you luck with that. Sebastian, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.